Welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts, sitting in for Ed Bell today. Thanks so much for joining us. Lots of great conversation about the arts coming up this hour. But first, the Museum of Art at Nova Southeastern University has a lot for us to look forward to this season. And our regular contributor, Judy Bishop, recently spoke with Bonnie Clearwater, the executive director.
Bonnie Clearwater made her mark in the New York art world, where she was curator of the Rothko Collection. Then she took Miami by storm as chief curator at MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art. Now she's working her artistic magic in Broward County at the NSU Art Museum, Fort Lauderdale. During her two-year tenure there, the museum has increased new membership by 150%. She's ramped up both the number and the quality of exhibitions. And she's added Starry Night Thursdays, when the museum stays open until 8 o'clock and presents lectures, films, book discussions, and performances. Bonnie Clearwater is our guest today on South Florida Arts Beat with a preview of the fall season and beyond. Bonnie Clearwater, welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. It is always great to see you and have you on our program. It is a very, very busy time for you at your museum. One exhibit in particular is getting a lot of attention. It got a rave in The New Yorker, which is great. It is a Haitian photography show curated by Edouard Duval Carré. And as everyone knows, Haiti has certainly had a very turbulent recent history. How has that reflected the culture and the history and the traumas in the photography?
Well, it's a very interesting exhibition. First of all, it's the first ever history of Haitian photography exhibition, which tells you a lot right there. The photographs are from all different perspectives. We have official court photographies, as well as snapshots from everyday people, the kind of photographs that would be taken in a studio portrait for a family, to surveillance photographs that were taken by representatives of the U.S. military during the U.S. occupation of Haiti. And those were taken without any idea of being artistic, and yet there is something fascinating in the objectivity of those photographs.
They sound top secret. How were they procured?
They have been since declassified, and they are in an archives that was made available to us. So what's interesting about the exhibition, it is told from multiple perspectives for multiple purposes, and it therefore gives a much broader understanding of this very rich history. It's actually from the beginning of photography in the mid-19th century until 2012, after the earthquake. So you do get a sense of the history, both the turbulence and the politics and issues of occupation, as well as just everyday life. I mean, the idea that history is also enacted or performed by everyday people, not just the rulers and politicians. So it makes for a very fascinating, multifaceted perspective. There's over 250 photographs in this exhibition, and we feel we're just scratching the surface. We really recognize that this will be, maybe it's the first exhibition, but we hope it is just the first exhibition, because there is so much to research.
I'm always fascinated on how one names an exhibition. It can tell you a lot sometimes. You are presenting some Danish avant-garde works that were produced during World War II, and you've named it War Horses. How did you come up with that name?
Well, that was actually the name of the group, Helhest and the War Horse. It's a Norse mythology. And it really became, in a way, the symbol of resistance for these artists. Just think, Hitler and the Nazis declared modern art to be degenerate. And yet these artists in Denmark during World War II chose, as part of their resistance to occupation, by continuing to work in what was really very dangerous at the time, in the modernist mode. And not only did they produce work, abstract, surreal works that were, we would consider, using childlike imagery, everything coming from the modern period, but they also organized major exhibitions in the public of their work and published art journals that were widely distributed and critical of the Nazi occupation. So it's a fascinating group, and also to understand the bigger role of the unique role that the Danes played during World War II, in that when it came time that they were told to round up the Jews, that instead they organized and were actually able to help around 8,000 of the Danish Jews to escape to Sweden.
This is your second show dealing with the Cobra movement. Is that something that's going to become a recurring specialty?
Well, we are very fortunate that we have the largest collection of Cobra avant-garde artists in the United States. COBRA stands for Copenhagen, Brussels, Amsterdam, and it was a group of very experimental avant-garde artists that actually emerged right after the war. But the Helhesten group was the genesis for the movement. A lot of the artists that we associate with COBRA, such as Oscar Jorn, were part of the Danish group Helhesten. So we have made this area one of the focuses of the museum's collection, as well as exhibitions, and it's an extremely rich period to understand. These were not only experimental avant-garde artists, but it was a social political movement that reflects the larger period itself. We quite fortunate that COBRA is now be considered very hot as a area to collect, and there's going to be major exhibitions both in in New York and Los Angeles this year, and we have the largest collection of this work. It is amazing that this exhibition, The War Horses of Danish Art, is going to travel to a museum in Denmark, which to me is like sending coals to Newcastle. However, our collection has works from this period that are rare and therefore of great interest in Denmark and Scandinavia.
And as they are traveling out of Florida, your Glackens are coming back to NSU Fort Lauderdale after a very successful national tour. Where were they exhibited in other states? And tell us about how many paintings you have and what they depict.
William Glackens was one of the early 20th century American modern painters, not only as a painter, but he played a crucial role in introducing modern art to America. He was the personal friend and art advisor to Albert Barnes, the great eccentric collector, and in Philadelphia, who's has his own museum bearing his name. And the exhibition went to that prestigious museum last year, as well as to the Parish Art Museum in
Southampton.
Now, here's an artist who didn't have that much acclaim previously. He was well known for his participation in early American modernism. But as a result of this exhibition, we had front page coverage in the New York Times art section, full page in the Wall Street Journal, multiple publications. So, and they were all works from our collection that were featured in these prominent spots. So we are welcoming back our homeboy with a new installation from the collection that opens to the public on September 4th.
I think you're going to get a lot of press locally and nationally in October. You have some remarkable photos from a very remarkable photographer, Lee Miller. Her life reads like a movie script. Can you outline it for us?
It truly is remarkable, and what's even more remarkable is a movie has yet to be made of her life. Here we have one of the most beautiful independent women, American, born in Poughkeepsie in 1907. She has a number of traumatic experiences, including being raped. She came from a very forward-thinking family, and she lived very independently. Just by accident, she literally ran into, or he ran into her, Condé Nast, who published, among other things, Vogue and Vanity Fair. And he immediately asked if she would model for Vogue, and she became a favorite cover model for Vogue. But she was restless as a model in front of the camera, decided she wanted to be a photographer herself, takes off for Paris, knocks on the door of the famous surrealist photographer Man Ray, tells him she is going to become his student. He says, "I don't take students, and I'm leaving town today? And she said, now you do. And not only did she become a collaborator, but also his lover for a few years. She went on to become the first woman combat photographer, and this amazingly was for British Vogue, which continued to be able to publish during World War II because it was an American publication, Condé Nast. They were rationing paper, but because it was felt that this would be a form of propaganda to America, which was not yet in the war, they allowed British Vogue to continue to print. She was sent to France. She ended up in the middle of combat and started taking pictures. And for the next 2 years, followed the American infantry through liberation, including the liberation of the camps. And she is totally transformed by that experience. There is a white rage in her whenever she had to discuss the Holocaust, the camps afterwards, especially when anyone said to her it never existed. She felt compelled that her photographs were a way to counteract this disbelief, which happened right from the beginning. And I read her correspondence to her editor at British Vogue that said, believe me, this happened, I saw it. And she sends the photographs to show what happened in the camps.
I often think that if we had active TV service in every home in that era, everyone would know. And that sort of segues into your next show coming up, which is the genesis of television. And that show made headlines in the art world this summer when it was at the Jewish Museum in New York. And it's going to be right here in Miami and running through Art Basel.
Yes, and opens October 25th through January 10th. And it looks at the influence of the avant-garde modern art on the golden age of television. It's a fascinating exhibition. It's something that I'm very interested in, is how individuals who felt so strongly about modern art and the avant-garde, who were in the position of reaching the masses, how they were able to infiltrate their own resources in order to spread this aesthetic, these ideals. And this exhibition was extremely scholarly, but also great fun, and will be fascinating, especially with the resurgence of interest in that golden age as a result of Mad Men. But also, we are now entering the new golden age in television, not necessarily on the television set itself. So this exhibition will show the opportunities that were there right from the beginning in the golden age of American television.
Well, there was also a golden age, so to speak, in the fashion world, and that's coming up in February. This is a must-see show for both art lovers and fashionistas. You're calling it Bellissima, Italy and High Fashion from 1945 to 1968.
Yes, and there starts to look like there's a theme going on in our exhibitions, which there are as a result of the Cobra collection we've made as one of our focuses, World War II and its immediate aftermath and how it plays out to today. It's infinitely rich in so many ways to deal with it. So, yes, Bellissima is going to include about 200 of the most exquisite high fashion designs produced in Italy after the war. But really, the focus of this exhibition is how the after World War II, Italy was basically in ruins, its economy destroyed, and there was a fear from most of the West, from America and Europe, that it was in trouble, and particularly it might go communist. So there was a concerted effort to pump in money into industry in Italy, and particularly into the textile factories that would be able to be up and running quickly, and into the fashion industry, which appealed very much to the new rising, the American woman rising middle class. So there was a built-in trade as well as upper class, because, of course, that's what high fashion is for, I guess.
Well, that's a show we're going to look forward to seeing.
So it's really, it shows the relationship relationship between the artists, the filmmakers, and the fashion designers all working together to basically how was the word made in Italy by the creative industries after World War II.
Sounds terrific. Bonnie Clearwater, always wonderful to have you here on South Florida Arts Beat.
Well, thank you very much, Judy.
The NSU Museum, Fort Lauderdale, is located at 1 East Las Olas Boulevard. It's open Tuesday through Sunday and closed on Mondays. For more information, log on to nsuartmuseum.org or telephone 954-525-5500. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
And Judith Bishop is a regular contributor here on South Florida Arts Beat. She covers theaters and museums. Judith is a member of the Writers Guild of America. She's judged news and documentary awards for the Guild, as well as Emmy Awards for the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. And she's a recipient of two Associated Press Awards. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts, sitting in for Ed Bell this afternoon, and we'll be back in just a moment with Charles Greenfield and Shelley Berg, the dean of the Miami Frost School of Music, right after this break. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts, sitting in for Ed Bell. Do stay with us later this hour. We'll be joining film critic Dan Hudak, and we'll get a little taste of what's coming up in the Broward Arts calendar. But first, here's our regular contributor, Charles Greenfield, with Shelley Berg. He is the dean of the University of Miami's Frost School of Music.
Starting each October, the University of Miami's Frost School of Music's Festival Miami continues its dominant role as leadoff batter for the South Florida cultural arts season. Since its inception in 1983 under former music dean William Hipp, Festival Miami has changed from mostly Latin-based programming to a more encompassing series of programs. Under UM Dean of Music Shelley Berg, the series now consists of over 20 concerts divided into four themes: great performances, jazz and beyond, music of the Americas, and creative American music. Festival Miami's 33rd season begins October 16th with the Frost Symphony Orchestra and ends November 7th. Over the years, Festival Miami has presented world premieres including String Quartet No. 4 by Elliot Carter in 1986, Double Concerto for Flute, Double Bass, and Chamber Orchestra by Carlos Surinac in 1990, Concerto for Horn and Orchestra by Thomas Sleeper in 2000, and Sinfonia No. 2 by Roberto Sierra in 2005. As in the past, most concerts will take place in UM's Gusman Concert Hall. Recently, I had the pleasure to talk with Dean Shelton Shelley Berg about Festival Miami 2015. In our talk, we discuss highlights from the great performances and music of the Americas portions and go over concerts from jazz and beyond and creative American music sections of Festival Miami 2015. Dean Berg, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you, Charles. It's always great to be with you.
Many listeners may not know that in addition to your broad responsibilities as Dean of UM's Frost School of Music, you're equally gifted in classical as you are in jazz piano, as well as your work in arranging, writing, and composition. With that said, what special qualities do you look for in a performer in the selection process in planning Festival Miami?
That is a great question. Obviously, we're looking for great performers, great role models to our students, but we're also looking for people who are very engaging, who our audiences will love and feel a connection with.
Now, Festival Miami 2015 fires up October 17th with Billboard piano sensation Simone Dinerstein performing with the Frost Symphony Orchestra and works by Lasser, Hovhannes, and Hansen. Give us a brief summary of the young pianist and the three American composers' works.
Great. Well, October 16th is our opening night, and we're very excited about it. It's the Florida premiere of the Philip Lasser Concerto, which is a wonderful work that was actually commissioned by one of our supporters who lives in New York, Adam Glick. And Simona Dinerstein is one of the great pianists of our time, young pianist. She's highly praised, has not been heard much here. So I think it's very exciting to hear this new concerto in its Florida premiere, along with this work by Hovhaannis that was the beginning of the sort of Save the Whales movement. It's this fabulous symphony that actually has recorded whale sounds interjected. So it's going to be a fascinating concert of American music.
There are another 8 great performance evenings during the festival. Let's try to highlight them. October 18th, violinist Charles Castleman. October 24th, John Easterlin, who sings Broadway and opera. October 25th, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet. And October 28th, Chamber Music Treasures. And I believe you perform on October 24th.
Yes, John Easterlin is our outstanding alum for this year. He's had a tremendous career in opera and musical theater, currently doing Sweeney Todd with the San Francisco Opera for a PBS special. So that's sensational. Our new violin faculty member, Charles Castleman, one of the world's most renowned violin teachers, who left Eastman School to come teach for us, his debut recital here. The LA Guitar Quartet, of course, they're the top of the food chain for classical guitar groups. And probably the last record that Gunther Schuller produced featured our faculty member, Richard Todd, along with Joel Smirnoff and Christopher O'Reilly, and they're performing that music on campus.
To finish out the great performance schedule, there's Halloween, October 31st, with the Frost Symphony Orchestra and Harry Potter, November 1st with Black Violin, November 2nd, and the Frost Wind Ensemble, and November 4th with the Boston Brass. That's a lot of music.
Well, yes, one of our professors plays tuba in the Boston Brass, so there's a connection there. Symphony music for Halloween for kids, Hogwarts, Harry Potter, the kids are going to love that. Black Violin is the newest Universal Classics act. They fuse hip-hop with classical music, again, for young audiences getting into classical music. Tremendous. And we have a new wind ensemble conductor, Rob Carnahan. It's his first year. This is one of his first big concerts for us. Just great music.
Music of the Americas features 2 programs, October 17th with vocalist Raquel Sofia, a new Sony Music Latin artist, and Spotify 2015 Artist to Watch, and October 23rd, 3-time Grammy Latin winner Natalia Lafourcade with her new album Hasta la Raíz.
Well, there's so many Miami connections and University of Miami connections. Raquel Sofia is an alum of our school who Juanes discovered. She's a fabulous young talent. She was on his MTV special. This is really the beginning of her big career. So you can come hear her and say, I heard her when. And it's quite a coup for us to get Natalia Lafourcade. She's already a big star in Latin music. And to hear her in the intimacy of our 600-seat venue is very cool.
Let's discuss the other 2 sections of Festival Miami, Creative American Music and Jazz and Beyond. Creative American Music boasts some real showstoppers. October 20th, Johnny Mercer Reimagined. October 21st, Nashville Country All-Stars. October 30th, songwriter-writer Ben Folds with the Henry Mancini Institute Orchestra. It sounds like a lot of exciting, vibrant sounds from UM's Gusman Hall.
No doubt. There's an apocryphal story that Ben Folds was 3 credits shy of graduating from our school when he got into a disagreement with a professor and threw his drum set into the lake.
Oh my gosh.
It's all true, except he'd completed exactly 1 semester. He wasn't 3 semesters shy of graduating. But we'll have to take pictures of him with an old drum by the lake. But his piano concerto is fabulous. That's going to be a great night. He's a wonderful pianist, and the piece is awesome. The Johnny Mercer concert, the Johnny Mercer Foundation has asked our songwriting students to create new arrangements, new versions of Mercer music. So they're going to hear those, as well as a group of songwriters the next night who've written many, many country hits playing their hits.
Let's divide the Jazz and Beyond series schedule into 2 parts. October 22nd, Cuban pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba and the Frost Concert Jazz Band. October 27th, Sylvan Street, High Wattage Jazz Fusion, and French jazz vocalist Cyril Aimé on October 29th. Wow, the hall will be shaking.
The hall will be shaking, and I love your French accent.
Thank you.
Gonzalo Rubalcaba, of course, is one of the great, great top pianists of our time in jazz. He's also an artist in residence at the Frost School, and so as part of that, he's performing with our concert jazz band, or is that our studio? Concert jazz band, which is a terrific group, mostly undergrads, so they get the thrill of performing with him. Sylvan Street is led by our new marching band director, Jay Reese. When we went to hire our marching band director, I said, who's the best guy in the country? They told me Jay Reese. Fortunately, he's an alum of our school and a great jazz musician as well. So this is his jazz fusion group. Very exciting, very high energy. And if you haven't heard Cyrille Aimé, she is, of the younger generation of jazz singers, one of the most well-regarded. She is a delight. I've performed with her many times, and she'll be working with our award-winning JV1 group, so that's another great night.
I'm sure Edith Piaf would be very thrilled to hear her. The last three Jazz and Beyond series programs are jazz organist Joey DeFrancisco on November 3rd, Freda Payne and her Band of Gold, November 5th, and November 6th, Big Sounds from the Henry Mancini Institute Orchestra at the Arts Center's Night Hall with movie music of Spike Lee and trumpeter-composer Terrence Blanchard. A really big show, as Ed Sullivan would say.
Really big. yes. Well, if you're a jazz fan, you know Joey DeFrancisco. He is the greatest jazz organist of all time. And he's interested in doing a symphonic project with our Mancini Institute Orchestra. And so this will be a great chance for him to come. We're good friends. And for this, our audience is to hear his trio, which is spectacular. I'm going to perform with Freda Payne. Now, she's a great jazz singer, but she's best known for, you ready? Now that you're gone, all that's left is a band of gold.
Oh, my goodness.
That was her big hit. She's a great singer and a great jazz singer. So that's a special concert with a legend. And we're making the handoff. Terrence Blanchard is ending his time as artistic director of the Mancini Institute. And James Newton Howard will be beginning in the spring. And what perfect way to end this part of our relationship with a concert of some of his great music. Also on that concert, the great D.D. Bridgewater, Liz Wright. A couple of great jazz vocalists on that concert as well. So we are chock full on Festival Miami, my friend.
And finally, I hear you have some ideas on the closing act for November 7th. Any hints, any ideas we could get from that?
You're getting the scoop.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to play that night also. I was asked to. We got the Mills Brothers.
Wow.
Which is now run by the son of one of the original members. And they're fabulous. One of our faculty members plays with them and said, you know, you're still looking for somebody closing night, and they're available. So that's the history of the Great American Songbook. Every song they sing in this tight harmony is a beloved song from the American standards.
And you're involved in
that. And I'm going to play piano on that show.
Oh, boy. Well, I just have to tell you, it sounds so exciting. And Dean Shelleyberg, thank you for attending South Florida Arts Beat. And let's get going to Festival Miami starting October 16th.
Let's go. And thank you for having me on board, as always, Charles.
UM's Frost School of Music Festival Miami has become, over the last quarter century, the calendar starting point for South Florida's cultural season. More than a mere filler series during the preseason, Festival Miami now represents the region's growing sense of musical continuity and integration into a larger national and international musical world. For more information on Festival Miami 2015 and tickets, call 305-284-4940 and go to their website, festivalmiami.com. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield is a Miami-based travel writer who has been featured in many regional magazines and newspapers. He's, of course, also a regular cultural contributor here on South Florida Arts Beat. He writes on classical and jazz musicians for the Miami Herald. We'll be back with film critic Dan Hudak in just a moment. Stay with us for the break. This is South Florida Arts Beat. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts, sitting in for Ed Bell today. Thanks again for joining us. And coming up just a little bit later, we'll have the Broward Arts Calendar with Jody Horn-Lashinsky. But our film critic, Dan Hudak, paid a visit recently to the Miami Beach Cinema.
It was an all-out war, and it happened, at least in part, right here in South Florida. While the 1968 Republican National Convention played out in Miami Beach, backstage at the convention, intellectuals William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal duked it out in a series of debates that were supposed to discuss the pressing issues of the time. What transpired instead was a war of words unlike anything television had ever seen, and with it came the birth of talking head pundits on TV. The documentary Best of Enemies, in theaters now, chronicles the seething hatred shared by William F. Buckley, a prominent Republican and the leader of the cultural conservative movement, and Gore Vidal, a novelist and well-known Democrat who believed Buckley's ideas would single-handedly ruin the country. Both men would emerge from the debates bitter and scarred, and carrying with them a passionate hatred for the other that would last until their dying days. Here's an excerpt from the trailer for Best of Enemies, which concludes with a small taste of how Buckley and Vidal went after one another.
These were two visions of America clashing.
Each thought that the other was quite dangerous.
All this security makes me very nervous, because it's necessary, apparently.
If Buckley were not taken out, his ideas would take down the nation.
The country is being split at the seams.
It's almost as if they were matter and antimatter.
Say that again. Freedom breeds inequality. Now say it a third time.
No, yeah, twice is enough.
He's always to the right and almost always in the wrong.
I confess that anything complicated confuses Mr. Vidal.
He's
nothing feigned. They really do despise one another.
With Best of Enemies opening in theaters this weekend, I recently spoke with a co-director of the film, Robert Gordon, to discuss his approach to telling the story and remaining objective when it would have been easy to pick a side. Robert, thank you for joining us on South Florida Arts Beat.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me on.
So the film is objective in the sense that you clearly don't take a side between Buckley and Vidal. You try to stay, in my estimation, pretty down the middle. Why tell the story that way?
Thank you very much for saying that, first of all, because the vast majority of the reactions are the same. And the reason is because we were not trying to take us. This isn't about the argument. This is about how we argue. You know, we were trying to take a position and tell a story from a wider perspective. And I think it's interesting, just to make a quick note to you, that audiences today have become so accustomed to being fed a particular side that movies or political themed stories must take a propaganda side. So I think it's interesting that you're opening with that. Go, man, go.
Well, it's fresh because you're absolutely right. Most documentaries, something like a Michael Moore documentaries, are clearly trying to get us to believe one thing. But what I'll tell people is that documentaries need some kind of conflict, usually, or some kind of pull or trigger in the story to keep us hooked. For you guys, you and Morgan Neville, the other co-director, had the unique opportunity to tell a story that was that had the innate conflict, so you could be about this dissension between the two guys without having to choose between them. And it was a wonderful luxury that I think the story just kind of naturally presented itself to you.
Well, it was, in the various test screenings over the development of the film, one of the things we'd always ask, it would be a small group of people, friends of ours, and we'd say, did you feel like, we were leaning one way or the other? And we always took note of that. But we pretty much hit a middle stride early on and were able to maintain it with a little tweaking here and there. And you're right, the two men provide the conflict themselves. And to me, what they do, even though they're speaking, when I saw a bootleg DVD of those debates in 2010, I couldn't believe how contemporary it was. It felt like these two guys were expressing the culture wars that we live in. And so, like you said, we were able to let them do their battle while we could step back another circle, get a wider view and let the audience begin to realize that this is a very contemporary story, even though it's old, and that if we, a lot of times you can see things in the future or the present more clearly by looking in the past.
We're talking with Robert Gordon, the co-director of Best of Enemies. It's in theaters now. Is there a modern talking head that either Buckley or Vidal reminded you of?
Well, it's funny. There was one talking head that that reminded us of both of them, and that was Christopher Hitchens, who passed away a few years ago. And we interviewed him in the film. Actually, we were working on this film so long that we interviewed him before he was sick. And because of his history going from a liberal-leaning, left-leaning way of thinking and switching to the right, we thought the only possible comparable situation would be if he interviewed himself.
Was there anything about William F. Buckley or Gore Vidal that surprised you to learn? Obviously, you knew about them, you knew about the debates, but as you researched, as you put the project together, what surprised you?
Well, I knew a little more about Vidal than I knew about Buckley, so my surprises came from things I learned about Buckley. One thing I learned about Buckley was that he was not afraid to change his mind in public. You know, that he had been a segregationist, and then he realized he was wrong, and he stood up and said, I was wrong. He did that early in his career, in the 60s, and then late in his career, in the 2000s, he did something similar on the Iraq War. And I really thought that was admirable, that's an admirable trait in a political philosopher.
Right, especially,
I was wrong.
Especially a cultural conservative political philosopher.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I would agree with that. Wasn't it just delicious to watch them, the seething hatred they had for one another, and to watch them go back and forth, it almost with passion. And it's kind of sad in a way, but at the same time, it's also just wonderfully entertaining.
I tell people that this movie is very, very funny until it's not funny at all.
Right.
And you use the word delicious. And to me, and that word is not in any of our promotional material, and so many people use that when introducing the film. To me, it suggests that our country has a hunger for this kind of intellectual back and forth. You know, now people dumb it down. These guys didn't dumb, even when they spent so much time digging at each other, their personal prods against the other are on a high-minded, sophisticated, humorous level. And we don't get that anymore. You know, now it's just shouting. Who can be the loudest? And you mentioned passion. You know, the stakes between them were the future of the nation. They each felt like they were arguing to save the republic. And we sense that passion. And now it seems like the arguments are who can win the round before the next commercial, and then we'll start over again.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, all that burning intensity is present in the raw material between them.
I did find it curious. Again, we're talking with Robert Gordon, the co-director of Best of Enemies in theaters now, how they at times seemed more consumed with taking shots at one another than they did actually debating the issues that they were there to debate.
In a way, I think that's part of what makes it contemporary. You know, that hadn't happened prior in public discourse. One of our early slogans, or one of our early catchphrases when we were trying to figure out what this movie was about, was we would just say to ourselves in the editing room, when did civil discourse become uncivil? Hmm. You know, and when they're doing these personal digs, this is at a time when identity politics is forming. So each of these guys, their life, their lifestyle, Vidal's pansexuality and promotion of homosexuality as a legitimate, you know, position, which was so far ahead of its time. This is when, and Buckley's, you know, corporate stance, strong religious position. This is when the personal was becoming political. So for all that personal digging, it really does kind of have a political echo or ramification.
So Robert Gordon, director of Best of Enemies, the film's in theaters now, all about the 1968 debates between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. I want to get you out on this question. And the movie's out. The movie speaks for itself. We are now looking back on it and the success of the film. So I can ask, and you can answer honestly, sir, who won the debates?
All right. Well, you know, in the moment of 1968, I think it's pretty clear that Buckley lost, because Buckley loses his cool and threatens violence against Vidal. But in the decades that followed, Buckley clearly won. You know, he was the one who was promoting Reagan in 68, and when Reagan achieves office in 1980, all through the 80s, that's the apogee of Buckley's work. But then, now that we're in the, you know, 2010s here, the idea that Vidal was promulgating, which were so far ahead of their time, are coming to be.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's this remarkable, you know, this film gives us this opportunity to see the way, how long these arguments we've been having go on. People today, most, you know, it was very surprising to me in the making of this, in the beginning of the making of this, how few people today knew who William F. Buckley Jr. or Gore Vidal was. And so I think this gives an opportunity for us to realize that these debates that are so current really have roots going back decades, and that the arguments will continue, but they don't have to be so low level. You know, they don't have to be so low-minded. We can do it with more sophistication and erudition.
Fantastic. Good stuff. Robert Gordon, Best of Enemies is the film. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Best of Enemies is in South Florida theaters now. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Dan Hudak.
Dan Hudak has worked extensively as a film critic in print, radio, and television, and Dan's films reviews are syndicated throughout the country. He's the former chairman of the Florida Film Critics Circle. He's a member of the Southeastern Film Critics Association, and you can learn more about Dan at punchdrunkmovies.com. We're going to take another break right now. We'll be back with the Broward Arts Calendar and Jody Horn-Lashinsky after this. And I'm here with Jody Horn-Lashinsky. She's the assistant director for the Broward Cultural Division. Jody, what's coming up in Broward in the next few weeks?
Well, Caroline, we have so much going on because we are coming to the end of our Broward 100 year. And the grand finale will take place in October. And we are working at breakneck speed to get ready for Duende, which is October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. But in the meantime, four new locations were recently added to our list of Inside Out projects in Broward County, and Inside Out is a global public art project that was initiated by French artist JR, who won the TED Talk International in 2011. The newest large-format black and white portrait mural installations are the Young Professionals Network of the Urban League of Broward County, the Broward County Main Library, the City of Tamarack, and the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Inside Out is a global platform for people to share their untold stories and transform messages of personal identity into works of public art. There's been more than 230,000 people from more than 124 countries around the world, and Broward County will have more than 5,000 images created by the end of October. On Wednesdays, September 9th at 6 p.m., Broward Cultural Division will conduct a grant workshop, a grant application workshop, for the Cultural Diversity Program. The workshop will take place on the 7th floor of the Broward County Main Library in Fort Lauderdale. There is no fee for the workshop, but please RSVP at broward.org/arts. The Art and Culture Center of Hollywood partnered with the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport to celebrate Broward County's 100th birthday by installing a 12-foot-tall puppet of Napoleon Bonaparte Broward. And if you don't know who he was, he was the governor. Governor Broward will be on display in the baggage claim area of Terminal 1 through October 5th. And the puppet was created by three-time Emmy Award-winning artist Wayne White during a 10-day artist residency at the Art and Culture Center of Hollywood. So, Caroline, we have a whole list of events, and I'm going to whip through these pretty quickly.
Okay.
These are sanctioned events through Broward 100. On Friday from 8 to 11 p.m., BACA, which is the Broward Contemporary Arts in Pompano Beach, presents Brazilian Sessions, Beatrice Malnick Trio, Malnick has performed and recorded with many Brazilian music luminaries, including the Brazilian pop superstar Toquinho. On Sunday, the Fort Lauderdale Orchid Society will be at the J.M. Lexus Sunday Jazz Brunch celebrating Broward County's 100th anniversary by giving away 100 native orchids found throughout South Florida. You need to show proof of residency of Broward County to receive one free orchid per household. Now through September 14th, Outre Theater Company presents Bed and Sofa at the Abdo New River Room at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. This enchanting three-character silent movie opera is based on Abram Room's scandalous 1926 Russian film comedy. NSU Art Museum Fort Lauderdale hosts the exhibit From Within and Without, The History of Haitian Photography through October 4th. The exhibition's nearly 350 works from the late 19th century to the present engages the history of photography in Haiti with the work of contemporary artists and photographers. On Saturday, September 12th, from 5 to 1 p.m., Margate Under the Moon will create a venue where residents can share their love for art, music, and culture on the northwest corner of Margate Boulevard and 441. Also on Saturday, September 12th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the City of Dania Beach presents its Founders Day celebration at Dania Beach City Hall. The event is free, and you should bring your lawn chairs for a day of food, fun, and entertainment. The 18th annual Lauderdale by the Sea Craft Festival takes place September 12th and 13th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. along A1A and Commercial Boulevard. You can visit with more than 100 artists exhibiting and selling their work in an outdoor gallery. The Art Brazil exhibition will be on display at ArtServe through September 25th. Evolving from its modernist roots, 21st century Brazilian art is known for vibrant colors, international urban influences, and trend-setting tendencies in painting, sculpture, glassworks, and other mediums. The Sunrise Civic Center Theater and Gallery presents a world music concert featuring Jorge Alfano on Saturday at 8 p.m., from the tablas of India to the quina quina flute of the Andes, Argentinian gauchos and Bollywood dancers. It will keep everyone entertained. On Monday, September 7th, from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., learn from the experts of Flamingo Gardens with tours, presentations, and exhibits during their annual Native Bird Festival, and best of all, Labor Day is half price. On Friday, September 11th, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., come dressed in your best Hawaiian shirts to celebrate Hawaii and the Polynesian Islands at Destination Friday event at the African American Research Library and Cultural Center. Dance to live island music and learn to hula. Take a virtual trip to Hawaii. Channel your inner child and try your hand at the ukulele. If you would like more detailed cultural event information, please visit artscalendar.com, Broward County's complete guide to the arts. Never miss a thing. Get there.
Well, Jody, thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful Labor Day weekend.
Thank you, and I hope everybody out there has a safe weekend.
And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts. I'm sitting in today for Ed Bell, our producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. And Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks, as always, to the amazing Andy Wagner, who is our technical director today. Also like to thank our contributors, Charles Greenfield, Judith Bishop, and Dan Hudak, and of course, my friend Jody Horn-Lashinsky. You can feel free to call us with your comments. That number is 305-995-2258. Monday, we've got an interesting program coming up for you at 1 p.m. It's called Fired, Tales of Jobs Gone Bad. Most of us who earn a living have at one time or another been fired, let go, downsized, outsourced, canned. And you'll hear some funny, compelling, often hilarious stories at 1 p.m. here on WLRN. And I'm back with Topical Currents with Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Have yourself a great weekend. Always keep your dial set to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Thanks so much for joining us today.